This year, as in most years that are not leap years, we have the two parshas of Acharemos and Kedoshim together, and we'd like to have a look at sections of both of those parshas, and we begin with Acharemos. Acharemos, of course, the beginning certainly, is known to us not only as one of the parshas of the Torah, but as well, of course, as the laning for Yom Kippur morning, containing as it does the special avoda for Yom Kippur. And the avoda of Yom Kippur has many unique features, and prominent amongst these features are the Shnei Se'irim, the two goats, which, as we know, there's a lottery that's cast, a goral, and one of them is brought as a korban, and the other is cast away, sent to Azazel. And, of course, as we approach Yom Kippur, there is much thematic material in terms of understanding the message of the Shnei Se'irim. What I would like to do within the context of our Parsha Shir is actually to take a look at a Parshanut element within these two goats. And as we will see, it may begin there, but it will extend way beyond there. And we preface by referring to a Mishnah in Maseches Yuma, which discusses these two Se'irim, these two goats. And in fact, the Perek is known, I believe it's the sixth Perek, Shnei Se'irim, as it discusses the two Se'irim in detail. And the Mishnah states that the mitzvah for these two Se'irim is that they should be identical in as many ways possible. That is to say, for example, they should be of similar height and similar appearance in terms of presumably color, similar identical value, purchased at the same time, as far as possible, they should be the same. And the question is, why? Where does this come from? Does the Torah speak about this? The Torah says there's two of them. Do they have to be the same? And the Gemara expounds. The Gemara says, actually, yes, the Torah does indicate to us that these two Se'irim need to be identical to each other as far as possible. How so? For a simple reason, says the Gemara, the Torah, if we have the Pasuk before us, the beginning of Acharemos, the Psukim certainly, I think, are well known to us. Perek Tet Zayin Pasuk Hei, Umei Eis Adas B'nei Yisrael, from among the congregation of Yisrael, Yikach, Aaron should take, Shnei Se'irei Izim Lechatos, two Se'irim, and then the Torah goes on to describe what happens with them. The Gemara makes a startling assertion, and that is that within the phrase Shnei Se'irei Izim, two goats, the word shnei is redundant, for the simple reason that as soon as you say se'irei izim, which is the plural, and the minimal plural is two, and you didn't specify any other number, so we come to understand that there's two of them. One may add in this case that the Torah will go on to talk about this one and that one. It's very clear that there are only two of them. But the Gemara says that from the very beginning. As soon as you say Se'irei Izim, without any additional clarification or explication, I know that there's two of them. Which makes the word Shnei redundant. If I don't need the word Shnei to tell me there's two, and the Torah uses Shnei anyway, it means not only that there are two of them, but they are a pair. in the sense that they are similar to each other in every way possible. So to review in summation, the Gemara is relating that whenever you have two of something, and the Torah says there's two of something, that's always redundant. Because just use the plural, and I'll know there's two. And if the Torah nevertheless says that there are two, it means they have to be identical to each other. And this begins with the Mishnah about the Shnei Se'irim, but the Gemara there in Maseches Yuma, Daf Samech Vav, Samech Zayin, proceeds to state that this is equally true for many other Shneis. In last week's Parsha, in the beginning of Metzora, there are two birds that are taken, Shtei Tziporim, and once again, says the Gemara, those two birds need to be identical to each other for exactly the same reason. If you say Tziporim, I know there's two. There's obviously more than one. You didn't specify. I'm not entitled to assume there's more than two, and therefore my net result will be two. And the same is true for the two Kivsei Karbonos of Musaf of Shabbos, Uvayom HaShabbos, Shnei Chavasim Menei Shana Timimim. Once again, the word Shnei is redundant, and so on and so forth, and there are other examples as well. So what we derive from here is that if I know there's two, or if I would be inclined or entitled to assume that there's two, and the Torah nonetheless says that there's two, it means that the two are the same. Interestingly, and parenthetically, according to the Vilna Gaon, this is really the driving force behind a very well-known discussion all the way back in Parshas Bereishis, whereby we have the idea that the sun and the moon were originally created equal in size, and then something happened. The moon says you can't have two kings sharing the same crown, whatever that means. And as a result of that, the moon was diminished. Now, of course, beyond the conceptual discussion as to the meaning of all of that, how can the moon complain, and so on, and why does this impact on us? We seem to take this very personally, at least on a national level. Kiddush Levana, we want the moon to be replenished and restored to its original glory. The Jewish people are like the moon. There's much to discuss in terms of the concepts there. But the question is, what is the basis in the Pasuk, in the Chumash, for this notion that originally they were created equal, and then something happened? Where does it come from? It has to come from a pasuk. It's not a self-evident truth that we hold that all the luminaries were created equal. The answer is that, well, the Gemara in Maseches Chulin discusses this and says, because initially, the pasuk says, let's read it in Bereishis Perek Aleph, Pasuk Tet Zayin, Vayas Elokim es Shnei Hama'oros HaGadolim, Hashem made the two great luminaries, es ha-ma'or ha-gadol le-memsheles ha-yom, es ha-ma'or ha-katon le-memsheles ha-layla. So it begins by describing them as shnei ha-ma'oros ha-gadolim, and proceeds to talk about the gadol, which is the sun, and the katon. So that seems to be dissonance from the beginning of the pasuk to the continuation of the pasuk. Rather, says the Gemara, something happened. Originally they were shnei ma'oros ha-gadolim, and then they became Gadol and Katan. The Ibn Ezra, in his discussion of that pasuk, says, I don't really see that there's a contradiction between calling them both Gedolim and then one Gadol is Katan. Relative to all of the other luminaries, for us, they're both Gedolim. I mean, they loom larger than all the others, as far as we're concerned. Between them, or among them, one is bigger and one is smaller. That may well be, but that's not a contradiction to calling them both Gedolim vis-a-vis the stars, which for us are much smaller for our vantage point. And therefore the Ibn Ezra raises his questions here as to where do we see a contradiction between them being Gedolim and then Gadol and Katan. Says the Vilna Gaon, the contradiction isn't coming from them both being Gedolim. The notion that originally they were both equal in size isn't because the Torah first calls them Gedolim. That could be like the Ibn Ezra. Rather, it's because the pasuk says Vayas Elokim es shenei hamaoros hagadolim. This idea comes back again now. We see it expressed so early on that the word shenei again is redundant. You have the maoros hagadolim, the gadol and the katan. I know there's two of them, but since the pasuk says shenei hamaoros hagadolim, that teaches us that they were shavim nivru, created equal, which now is in tension with one being called the bigger and one the other called the smaller, because something happened. So that all comes back to the use of the word shenei, says the Vilna Gaon. Now, it's interesting to note that if we look through Rashi's Peirush on the Chumash, we will see that Rashi never, ever mentions this idea. If you look at the beginning of Acharemos, Shnei Se'irim, we're ready to have Rashi citing the words of Chazal, that they should be equal. Rashi says no such thing. He doesn't make this comment, not by the Shnei Se'irim, not by the two birds of the Metzorah, not by the two Korbanos of Musaf, and not by anything. He never talks about this. And there's room to ask why. After all, it's explicit in the Gemara, and it's based on a redundancy, and the Gemara has its response. Why does it not register as a concern in Rashi's Peirush? And the question is an important question, and the answer is equally important. We come back to the difference between the two disciplines of Pshat and of Drash. Pshat, as we know, means straightforward, and the goal is to have a straightforward reading of the Pasuk. Pshat is not looking for trouble. If you get from the beginning of the Pasuk to the end and no issues were raised, good. It's a good result. Drash goes back again. And the word lidrosh, as we've mentioned so many times, means to seek. It is seeking resolutions to questions that aren't really issues for the pshat. But on a microscopic level, on a level of scrutiny, certain things come up. And this is responsible for so many of the Gemara's comments vis-a-vis the psukim. If they're born of drash issues, what is Rashi's approach in his commentary to the Torah? He tells us, Reishis Perek Gimel Pasuk Ches, Ani lo bosi ela lepshuta shamikra. I've only come to explain the pshat, and I've come to present the pshat. V'la agoda hamiyasheves es apshat, and also to agodos, drash statements of Chazal, that resolve pshat issues. In other words, if should we ask the question, does Rashi only ever give pshat explanations? No. He will also give drash explanations. Whatever works. Pshat wherever possible, drash wherever necessary. So Rashi's commentary is both a pshat and a drash commentary in terms of the explanations that he gives. But in terms of the issues that he responds to, there is no duality. He only ever responds to a pshat issue. If the pshat issue has been raised, Rashi will respond to it with whatever he can. Pshat or drash. But if the issue doesn't exist on a pshat level, it may exist on the scrutiny of drash level, says Rashi, that's for the Gemara. And that's the Gemara's area of expertise, of specialty, is to darshan the psukim. Rashi's job is not to darshan the psukim, it's to resolve pshat issues as they arise in the psukim. What does this have to do with us? When we come to consider whether a word is redundant, sometimes the answer depends on, well, through which lens are you looking at it? Are you reading this pasuk in a pshat way or in a drash way? Because very often the very same word, if your lens is one of pshat, and you're looking for a straightforward read, on a straightforward level, a word might not be redundant. But if you go back again and expose it to the process of drash and working it through and scrutinizing, etc., you might come to consider that very same word now to be redundant. Classic example is the word shnei. In our parsha, the pasuk says that Aaron should take two goats. Velakach shnei se'irim. Is the word too redundant? In terms of a straightforward reading, it's what we would call derech hakosov. That's completely normal. You introduce two things, and then you can speak about, as if to say, to the level of scrutiny that we subject the pasuk to from on a pshat journey through, this is completely in order. And therefore, it doesn't stand out as redundant. If it's not redundant, Rashi won't respond to it. There's nothing to respond to. The Gemara talks about this everywhere, because that's the Gemara's job. If you look through Drash and you say, well, if you use the word Se'irim, then mathematically I know it's more than one, and without further explication I can deduce that there's two of them. The Pshat doesn't wait for you to deduce things. The Pshat says, say there's two, and there's two. And therefore, the Drash sees an issue here and responds. And Rashi will be the first one to agree with that. And by the way, Rashi has a Perush on the Gemara also, and that's where he'll talk all about these things. But in terms of his Perush on the Chumash, it has no entry here. It's a non-issue. Amazing situation. It's such an ongoing theme throughout the Gemara, and absolutely absent in Rashi's Perush, for the very reasons that we call Pshat and Drash. Now, I will admit, I had a bit of a shaila, because here we are saying Rashi never responds to this issue of the word shnei being redundant. It doesn't mean identical as far as Rashi is concerned. But isn't it true that Rashi in Parshas Bereishis cites that Gemara about the beginning of the pasuk, that the sun and the moon were equal in size, and then one of them changed? The Vilna Gaon told us that is a product, that contradiction is a product of the Torah's use of the word shnei. Shnei means similar, and then they're dissimilar. But Rashi never gets involved in the word shnei. But he does bring that Gemara. So I had a look at the Rashi there, and I found something very interesting. In Bereishis Perek Aleph, Pasuk Tet Zayin, that's where it is, and Rashi says they were created equal, Shavim Nivru, Vinismat Alevana, and then the moon was diminished. But as students of Rashi know, learning Rashi doesn't start with Rashi's words. Learning Rashi starts by noting which words in the Pasuk Rashi quotes as the words that he is commenting on, what we call the Dibur HaMaschil. What is the Dibur HaMaschil of Rashi's comment there about the sun and the moon? It's the words HaMa'oros HaGedolim, the great luminaries. In other words, Rashi, when he cites this idea that they're originally created equal in size, unlike the Ibn Ezra, he does see that as soon as you call them Gedolim, it sounds like they're the same. And to go on and call one Gadol and one Kata means something happened. He doesn't accept what the Ibn Ezra says, that they're both Gedolim vis-a-vis the stars, but between them one is bigger and one is smaller. No, as far as Rashi's concerned, it jars on a pshat level to call them Gedolim in one breath and Gadol and Katan in the next breath. That's a pshat issue. And conspicuously absent from Rashi's citation from the pasuk is the word shnei. The expression in the pasuk is Hashem made shnei hama'oros hagedolim. Rashi doesn't include the word shnei in his Dibur HaMaschil, because the word shnei is not where he's getting the idea that they were created equal from. It's the word gedolim itself. And therefore Rashi remains consistent with his approach. The word shnei will never move him to say that things are equal. Rather, there must be something else going on. Having said this, our journey in this Rashi or in these Rashis is almost complete, but it is not fully complete until we come to consider a case where Rashi really does seem to have engaged in the pasuk the way the Gemara does, to see the word, the number, as redundant and say that it means equality. Where does this happen? in the end of Chumash Bamidbar. In Parshas Matos, the beginning of the Parsha, the Jewish people wage a war against Midian. And within the course of that war, they kill a number of the kings of Midian. All of them, we assume. In Perek Lamed Bamidbar, Perek Lamed Aleph, Pasuk Ches. The Pasuk reads as follows. Ve'es malchei Midian hargu al chaleim. They killed these kings of Midian. And who are they? Es Evi, ve'es Rekem, ve'es Tzur, ve'es Chur, ve'es Reva. Okay. It mentions five kings. Chameshes malchei Midian. Five kings of Midian. Says Rashi, and his Dibur HaMaskil is the words Chameshes Malchei Midian. Says Rashi, V'chi eini roa shechamisha mona hakosav? Why does the Pasuk say there's five of them? I can't count. I don't know that. The Pasuk mentioned five people by name. That's five. So lama huskok lomar chamesha. So why does it need to tell me that there's five of them? There's a lesson here, says Rashi. L'lamedcha titichu sheshavu kulam be'etza. They were all of these five kings, most of whom we've never really even heard of, but now we need to know, they were equally involved in the Eitza, to seduce the Israelites, v'hushvu kulam be'peronus, and they were equally receiving of retribution. So they're all equal. So says Rashi. Our question, of course, is, why is Rashi talking about this? Why is Rashi raising this issue? This is the type of thing that we've seen the Gemara talks about it. The number's redundant if you can count. The Gemara talks about it, but Rashi never mentioned it. Not in Brachos, not in Shemos, and not in Vayikra, and not in Bamidbar until now. So manishtana ha-pasuk hazeh mikol ha-psukim, that Rashi says, all of a sudden starts talking like the Gemara, and the word chameshes is redundant. I believe the answer, I hope, is not over simple, but is simple. This case is different. In all of the other cases, the word shnei is mentioned first. That's an introductory way of talking. There's two birds. One is like this and one is like this. There's two se'irim. One goes here, one goes here. And so on. And therefore, Derech HaKosov is first to tell me there's two of them and then to get down to details. Here's what's not Derech HaKosov. To tell me all the details and then tell me how many there were. The Pasuk doesn't say that in this war they killed the five kings of Midian, A, B, C, D, and E. Rather, it says they killed A, B, C, D, and E, the five kings. So you've already gotten down to details. Why now do you mention that there's five of them? Says Rashi, even I'm getting involved here. That's a pshat question. To go back from the prat to the klal, and I think it's meduyak in Rashi's words. Rashi raises the question, v'chi eini ro'eh, in this five kings of Midian situation, do I not see shechamisha mona hakosov, that the Torah has mentioned five? That's the problem. You've already mentioned them by name. Now to say there's five of them, says Rashi, we're all in. And the word chameshes, even on a pshat level, needs to be responded to. And Rashi responds. So it's an amazing situation because we see just how detailed the situation is and how sometimes something can change and all of a sudden it shifts from being a drash issue to a pshat issue. I think we might have gotten used to whenever you see numbers, we give it a pass. Derech HaKosov, and don't worry about it. Not on a pshat level. And Rashi never takes his eye off every single word. What is it saying? Where is it saying it? And what was said beforehand? And therefore, all the shnei, says Rashi, no comment, no comment. Shnei, no comment. Chamesha, says Rashi, yes, comment. Do not get used to just ignoring numbers. They're never ignored. It's normally Derech HaKosov, here's one for the books, where it's not Derech HaKosov, even on a pshat level. So, once again, we're reminded just how much there is in the Rashi. I think this evening, in this discussion, we've learned as much from what Rashi doesn't say as from what he does say. And that's also part of the limud. Rashi's silence contains a lot more than most other people's words. And that's Torah's Rashi. Another element moving on from the word Shnei, moving on in Parshas Acharemos, it's an idea that we've mentioned in the past, but I believe never from the vantage point of Parshas Acharemos itself, and it's so profound, and it's in Yonah Deyoma every single day. Not only in Yonah Deyoma as far as Maseches Yom HaKippurim, in Yonah Deyoma. One of the unique features of the Avodah is the fact that some of it takes place in the Kodesh HaKadoshim. That never, ever happens. The sprinkling of some of the bloods of the Korbanos, and so on. And as we can appreciate, Yom Kippur is the most sensitive day of the year. These are the most sensitive Avodos, and it goes all the way in. Lifnai v'lifne. We also know that when the Kohen Gadol enters the Kodesh HaKadoshim, he does not wear all the garments of the Kohen Gadol. The Kohen Gadol normally has 8 garments, and some of them are quite elaborate and have many different materials. But when he enters the Kodesh HaKadoshim, just white linen. That's it. And the Gemara discusses this. The Gemara says, because the other garments that the Kohen Gadol normally wears have gold thread them. If not gold thread, then gold itself. Says the Gemara, gold is not a good color on Yom Kippur. And certainly not in the Kodesh HaKadoshim. Because gold is reminiscent of the Egel HaZahav. That's not something that we wish to reminisce about. And therefore, there's no golden garments. What's called Big Day Zahav, there's regular garments, but rather it's only white. The implications of this are elaborated upon by the Meshech Chochma, because the idea that we don't wish to remind Hashem, so to speak, of the Egel HaZahav is more than just memory, and it's more than just history. The Gemara says in the final Perek of Sanhedrin, Perek Chelek, that the Jewish people, they receive a measure of retribution in every generation for the Egel HaZahav. Why is that so? Is it merely a slow release or a paying in installments? Says the Meshech Chochma, because the Chet HaEgel is the archetypical, from a national point of view, in our formative time as a nation, is the sin bin Adam Lamakom, between us and Hashem. Which means, if ever the Jewish people, in one way or another, will commit other sins in the realm of Bein Adam Lamakom, that is a perpetuation and a continuation of the Egel HaZahav. And they may receive retribution for it accordingly. It's almost like a relapse into the Egel HaZahav. And that's why we're looking to not have that interfere within the Kapara of Yom Kippur. What it means is, ultimately, the Kapara of Yom Kippur should trace its way all the way back to the root, even to the Chet HaEgel. Not only the sins that it begat, but even the parent sin itself. It says Meshech Chochma, if you look in the Medrash Shochet Tov on Mishlei, you will see there is another sin which is also described as accompanying the Jewish people down the ages, and that is the sin of the sale of Yosef. And the reason why, says Meshech Chochma, is exactly the same. Because what the Egel HaZahav is to between man and God, Ben Adam Lamakom, Mechiras Yosef is between man and man, Ben Adam Lachaveiro. It's the root sin of Ben Adam Lachaveiro, as the Jewish people was just beginning. And therefore, as to the extent to which the Jewish people continue to be remiss in the area of Ben Adam Lachaveiro, they are also perpetuating the sale of Mechiras Yosef. And they receive retribution for it. This flared up to a horrific degree at the time of the second Beis HaMikdash. The Asara Haruge Malchus, which around about that time, total 10. And that was because, as we know from the Piyutim and Eile Eskaro, as a retribution for the sale of Yosef, It's because this is at the time of the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash, which is due to Sinas Chinam. If Sinas Chinam flares up, so does Mechiras Yosef to a terrible degree that required that retribution. And the Medrash says it can continue. It's still going. Says Meshechachma. It turns out that in Yom Kippur, we're looking to achieve Kapara all the way back to the root in these two areas, Bin Adam Lamakam and Adam Lachavira. And we're looking to avoid indictment in these two areas, which explains two things. Number one, the Kohen Gadol, in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, he wears only white and not gold, so as not to bring about the indictment from this Egel Hazav, the golden calf. But why is he in the Kodesh HaKadoshim in the first place? The Gemara says that the territory of the Beis HaMikdash was divided between Yehuda and Binyamin. Bein Kesef Av Shachem. One of the areas that's entirely in the territory of Binyamin is the Kodesh HaKadoshim. Says Meshechachma, the most sensitive kaparas of Yom Kippur have to take place within the territory of Binyamin. Because Binyamin is the only son, the only brother who was not involved in the sale of Yosef. It's the only safe space. It's the only secure location on Yom Kippur from which to get full kapara, where there's no indictment in terms of the sale of Yosef. And that's the combination of dress and location. Big day Lavan for Egel Hazav reasons and Kodesh HaKadoshim for Mechiras Yosef reasons. That's really the combination of kapara. And Meshechachma concludes by explaining that this is what we mean when we refer to, in the Tfilis of Yom Kippur, we speak about the Jewish people in a way that we never do any other time of the year. We say, Ki ata solchan li Yisrael, umachalan l'shiv te Yeshurun. You forgive Yisrael, and you pardon the tribes of Yeshurun. Now, what is behind the double phraseology? Shivta Yeshurun, seemingly, or presumably, are none other than the Jewish people. It's another way to refer to them, but it's really the same thing. Says Meshechachma, no. Solchan li Yisrael, the forgiveness for Yisrael, and the Mechila for Shivta Yeshurun is not the same thing. These are the two domains. To be traced all the way back, the two domains have been Adam Lamakom and Bin Adam Lachavir. Bin Adam Lamakom, the root sin there is the Egel Hazav, which was done, performed by Yisrael. Eile Elohecha Yisrael, Asher Aducha Me'eretz Mitzrayim. So Solchan the Yisrael refers to the area Bin Adam Lamakom all the way back to the Egel. And what is Machalan the Shivta Yeshurun? The sale of Yosef, which was performed by whom? Shivta Yeshurun, the Shvatim, the tribes themselves. And this then is the duality that runs through Yom Kippur and is expressed in so many of halachas, also finds expression in the tefillahs themselves. And that's really the harmony of all of these realms that the Meshechachma so often brings. It goes from the machzor to the halachas, to history, to and everything in between. So having discussed one or two items from Parshas Acharimos, let us now turn our attention to an aspect of Parshas Kedoshim. And there's a pasuk that I'd like to press to focus on, and that is in Perek Yutes, pasuk Yud Dalet. Perek Yutes, pasuk Yud Dalet, which says, Lo sekalel cheresh. Do not curse someone who is deaf. Vilifnei iver lo sitein michshol. And do not put a stumbling block in front of a blind man. Lifnei iver lo sitein michshol. What we call in English, lifnei iver. To put a stumbling block in front of a blind man. What does it mean? What is the intent of this pasuk? What exactly is it prohibiting? Rashi comments. Do not put it, lifnei iver lo sitein michshol, Rashi quotes, as is dibur hamaschil. We are alerted duly to take note of that. Lifnei hasuma badavar. Someone who's blind in the matter, someone who's entering something blindly, doesn't really know what danger is or harm might come to him or detriment might come to him. Lo titin eitz ashena hogenesto. Don't give him advice that's bad for him. He'll stumble by that advice, and he doesn't know better. And Rashi gives an example. Al tomar mechor sotcha v'kach lecha chamor. Don't tell him, you know, it's the perfect time for you to sell your field. Invest in donkeys. Why? Because you want his field. And it's not good for him. And you're then waiting for the field is up for sale, and you're taking it. That's bad advice for him. And he doesn't know. So he's blind. That's Rashi's explanation of this prohibition of lifnei iver lo sitein michshal. Bad advice to someone who's blind in the matter. Interestingly, in the Gemara, we find another variation or iteration of this prohibition. The Gemara mentions it in a couple of places, Avodah Zarah Daf Vav and Psachim Daf Kaf Beis, not to enable a person to do an Aveira, not to provide someone with the wherewithal to do an Aveira. As the Gemara says, from where do we know that you shouldn't hand a cup of wine to a Nazir? Or you shouldn't hand a piece of Eiver Min Achai to a Gentile? That's one of the Shevet Mitzvos B'nei Noach. Talmud Lomar, the Pasuk says, V'lifnei Iver lo sitein michshal. And he's blind. Why is he blind? Says the Rambam in Hilchos Shemitah. He's blind because if he doesn't know that it's Osir, so then he's certainly blind. And if he does know that it's Osir and wants to do it anyway, so then he's certainly blind, says the Rambam. His Yetzer Hara has blinded him to what's right. It's an amazing, these are amazing definitions of blindness. So these are the two variations or applications of this prohibition in the realm of Chazal. The Taras Kohanim talks about bad advice. Rashi's source about bad advice is in the Taras Kohanim, the Safra. And the Gemara talks about providing the wherewithal to do an Aveira. And we should note that the Rishonim do not see conflict between these two explanations, and both the Rambam and the Sefer Chinuch mention both. They both begin by saying, Lifnei Iver means don't give a person, someone who's blind in the matter, bad advice, and go on to say, and do not provide someone with the wherewithal to do an Aveira, whether he knows it's Aveira or doesn't know that it's an Aveira. So in the end, both land in the Halacha. The Taras Kohanim's bad advice, and the Gemara's providing Aveira opportunities. The Shaila is, what about the Pasuk? In other words, it seems to be pretty straightforward. It seemingly couldn't be more straightforward. Lifnei iver lo sitein michshal. Do not put a stumbling block in front of a blind man. No one is talking about that. It sounds like, first and foremost, it means if someone is blind, do not put something in front of them that could cause them to stumble. That's what it seems to mean. And how do we even know that it means more than that? But many Mefarshim explain, and again, the classic example of what happens when we pay attention to detail, as certainly if we may have made something of a presumption. We're familiar with this prohibition of do not place a stumbling block in front of a blind man. Actually, the Pasuk does not say that, for the simple reason that the Hebrew word for to place is lasim. Ve'eile ha-mishpatim asher tasim lifneihem. To place something beforehand, vayasimu lefanav le'echol. So when you place something, that's called lasim. So the Pasuk should have said, v'lifnei iver lo tasim michshol. Don't place a stumbling block in front of a blind. He doesn't say that though. It says, v'lifnei iver lo titein michshol. If we translate that as accurately as we can, certainly as literally as we can, the Pasuk is saying, do not give a stumbling block in front of a blind man. But giving is not something that you do in front of someone. You give something to someone. You place something before someone. So how can you be giving something before someone? That's an interesting shaila. That's a compelling question. We so quickly maneuver or massage the words of the pasuk to mean what we assume they mean, but then we just worked backwards. We jump to a translation and then assume that that's what the pasuk is saying, but it isn't, not fully. And that is why the sources, the Taras Kohanim and the Gemara, they're alert to this. There is for sure more to this pasuk than just a blind man and a stumbling block. Because what the pasuk is talking about is something that not only that you place something before someone, but that you give to them. How can you give something to a person and cause them to stumble? Well, with bad advice. Or the wherewithal to do an aveira. Those are things that you give to the person and cause them to stumble. Amazing thing. The shaila, however, is, okay, if it's true from the word titain as opposed to tasim, there must be more to the pasuk than just the simple stumbling block. Things that you give the person. But is the pasuk also kipshuto? Meaning, must we abandon completely the idea that would be a Torah prohibition to put a stumbling block in front of the blind? We see there are other options, but is this simple understanding a non-option? Actually, in the writings of Rishonim, we see that some of them did understand the pasuk, also kipshuto. It's not a contradiction. We're back to, one could say, the pshat. There's a reason why the Torah speaks about it in that way. The straightforward reading, the simple reading, shall we say, really does seem to include an actual stumbling block and a blind man. A closer reading will yield further understandings. But the basic reading is still there. The Ramah, Rabbi Numer Halevi Abu Lafia, one of the great Rishonim of the 1100s, in his Sefer Yad Ramah on Maseches Bava Basra, actually adduces this pasuk in answering a very simple question. Does the Torah ever forbid damaging someone? That might sound like an overly simple question, but actually, if you look in Parshas Mishpatim, it is full of the payments that you need to make when you do damage someone. But does the Torah ever say, don't damage? The Torah says, don't steal. And don't kill. Does the Torah ever say, don't damage? Lo taziku. The Torah never uses those words. So is there an actual source in the Torah for the prohibition? Obviously, it's not a matter of if you can afford it, so then you can do what you want, just be sure to pay for it. But where does the Torah forbid it? Says the Yad Ramah, first and foremost, v'ahavta l'reicha kamocha, will cover all of these things. But he proceeds to say, v'lifnei iveil lo sitein mirshol. The Torah forbids you to do an action that could cause a person harm or damage. Kipshuto. Very interesting. The question itself is interesting. What is the source in the Torah for the prohibition against damaging someone? But in giving this answer, the Ramah indicates clearly that the pasuk is also to be understood kipshuto. It's physical damage. It's just not only that. And the Meshech Chochmah concurs with this in our parsha as well. And if a person would dig a pit in the public thoroughfare, your classic bor b'shur sarabim, he's violated the prohibition of lifnei ivel sitein mirshol. So the pasuk is also kipshuta. I will add, I think it's very interesting, even if we take this, the simplest understanding of this prohibition, that it's actually putting a stumbling block in front of a blind man and use it to explain all these other things, digging a pit in the public thoroughfare and so on, it's still not literally what the pasuk is saying. We've still moved away from the literal reading, by which I mean, the Torah forbids put a stumbling block in front of a blind man. What if he's not blind? But he could still be harmed. The prohibition against digging a pit in the public thoroughfare is not just because there might be a blind person there. There might be a person who has full vision, but they won't see the hole in the ground. So even what we're calling the pshat explanation is still exercising latitude in its moving away from the literal meaning of iver as a blind person to someone who will happen not to see it. At that point, he'll be blind, but he's not actually blind. He just won't see. And I think it's very interesting. would need to consult the unkelus experts. But in our pasuk, unkelus translates the word iver as delochaze, someone who doesn't see. Now the question is that the translation of the word iver? The word iver will appear in next week's parsha as well. It's one of the blemishes that can disqualify a Kohen if he's iver. So I had a look at unkelus there, and he translates the word iver as avir, meaning the same letters, just Aramaic of iver is avir. So in next week's parsha, iver is called avir. In our parsha, iver is called lochaze, someone who doesn't see. I think unkelus, even in his translation, is showing that it's not a literal translation. Even the pshat is not a literal translation. And often, we have seen that. The straightforward translation and the literal translation are not always the same. On the contrary, sometimes, in order to allow for a pshat translation, you have to broaden things a little bit. It says blind, it means a person who doesn't see that thing. It doesn't mean a person who has no vision, is blind physiologically. So these are some of the very interesting parshanut considerations with regards to what emerge as the three emanations of Lifnei Iver. Kipshuto, to cause a person to physically stumble and come to harm, bad advice, and the wherewithal for an avir. Let us come back to the two halachic explanations, which are the latter two, bad advice and averos, and ask a very interesting shaila. Are these two explanations of Lifnei Iver, are they the same? Meaning, are they variations on the same theme? Or are they different themes? And I'll explain the question. When it comes to the Peirush that Lifnei Iver means don't give bad advice. If you would give a person bad advice, we divide mitzvahs generally between bin Adam Lamokom and bin Adam Lachavero, as we've spoke about just before. To give a person bad advice lies squarely and very clearly within the realm of bin Adam Lachavero. You told him to sell his field, and now he's stuck with a donkey. That's bin Adam Lachavero. But what about the Gemara's explanation of Lifnei Iver? Don't give him the wherewithal to do an Avira. Is that also in the domain of Bin Adam Lachavira between man and man? Maybe. In other words, maybe what we're saying is don't allow your friend to come to harm. He can come to harm either by following bad advice or he could come to harm through doing an Avira. Just now he's done an Avera, he's been in a bad situation. He will suffer repercussions from that. Don't put him in that situation. Have Rachmanos on him. Which means that even if it's an Avera bin Adam Lamokom, don't give him non-kosher food. For him to eat the non-kosher food has been Adam Lamokom. But for you to give it to him has been Adam Lachavero, because you're putting him in a bad matzav. But could it be that perhaps this branch of Lifnei Iver, don't give a person non-kosher food or whatever it is actually in a different category. It's in the other category of Bin Adam Lamokom. It's about mitzvahs Bin Adam Lamokom. As if to say, not only does the Torah forbid you to eat non-kosher food, but it forgives you to enable anyone else to do so either. And it's all in the realm of Bin Adam Lamokom. So that's a very interesting possibility, because these two explanations of Lifnei Iver now belong and live in different categories of mitzvahs. Is that the case? And there are many who say that it is the case. And one of the ways that we see this is that the Sefer HaChinuch, when he introduces Lifnei Iver, says, you should not give a fellow Jew bad advice. As we said, the Chinuch and the Rambam start with bad advice and move on to wherewithal for Averus. But the Chinuch begins by saying, don't give your fellow Jew bad advice. Says the Minchas Chinuch, on the Sefer HaChinuch, don't give a fellow Jew bad advice. Sounds like the prohibition of Lifnei Iver only applies between you and your fellow Jew. There's no Lifnei Iver between you and a non-Jew. The Gemara flatly contradicts that. Because the two cases that the Gemara talks about of Lifnei Iver are, number one, as we mentioned, don't give wine to a Nazir, and don't give Eva Minachai to a Gentile. So we see that Lifnei Iver also involves bringing a Gentile to mishap. So why does the Sefer Achino say that Jews shouldn't give other Jews bad advice, seeming to limit the scope of the prohibition to the Jewish people? But that is why Mefarshim say that when it comes to the area of bad advice, that's been Adam Lachaveiro. The regimen of Ben Adam Mitzvah's Ben Adam Lachaveiro is between Jew and fellow Jew. We have goodwill towards non-Jews, but you're not bound by the Mitzvah's Ben Adam Lachaveiro towards them. As far as possible, Jewish people have a benevolent relationship with all of mankind. If they try and exterminate us, so we take exception to that. But all things being equal, but the Mitzvah's Ben Adam Lachaveiro is only for Jews. So the bad Eitzah, says the Sefer Chinuch, is only for one Jew to a fellow Jew. When the Gemara says you can't give a piece of Eivah Min Achai to a non-Jew, it's because that's not Ben Adam Lachaveiro, that's Ben Adam Lamakom. That explanation or that application of Lifnei Iver is Ben Adam Lamakom. Don't you do something that's osur? Don't you eat things that are forbidden to you? And don't allow anyone else to forbid to enable them to eat things that are forbidden for them. So it's an amazing situation. I think it's certainly one for the books. Again, where you have one mitzvah, not only does it open up into different branches, but those two branches are in two different fields. One's Ben Adam Lachaveir, one's Ben Adam Lachaveir. Ultimately, they're all one, but those are two separate categories. Let us conclude by referring to a fascinating shaila with regards to Lifnei Iver. It's based in the Shulchan Aruch and then discussed further by Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach. We know that before a person eats or drinks, they need to make a bracha. And it's usur to eat or drink without making a bracha. Meaning it's usur to be in neglect of making a bracha. It's for this reason, says the Shulchan Aruch, in Aruch Haim, Sim Kuf Samach Tes, that it's also to give food to someone if you know that they're not going to make a bracha. Because it's Lifnei Iver. You are leading them to transgress eating without making a bracha. If you know, says the Chazon Ish, if you don't know, give them the benefit of the doubt. But let's say you know, however you can know. So that's halacha in Shulchan Aruch. Says Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, which he discusses in the Tshuvos Minchas Shlomo, sometimes it's not so straightforward, and sometimes it's mutter to give such a person food, and it's even correct and better to give them food. But what does this mean? After all, what are we saying? We're saying that you can give them food even though they're not going to make a bracha. You put them in a situation where they're doing something wrong of eating without making a bracha. Says Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, I'll give you an example, an illustration. What if someone was eating food that is not kosher, meaning not kosher on a Torah level, absolutely d'oraisa forbidden? You happen to have in your possession food that is osur on a drabbanon level. And you know that if you offer them to replace the food, they'll take the food that you have. You're not going to eat it, obviously, but you have it somehow. What should you do? Should you make that offer or not? It's a bit of a conundrum. If you don't do anything, you sit there and that person is eating food that is osur min haTorah. So on the one hand, they're doing something much worse. On the other hand, you haven't done anything. On the other hand, if you offer them the Durabonon prohibited food, so they are doing something that's less, but you've gotten involved, and because of you, they're eating this forbidden food. The halacha in that case, says Rav Shlomo Zalman, is very clear, that if you can, you should substitute the Durabonon food for the Duraisa food prohibited. Because you're saving them from an Isser Torah. And in fact, he goes a step further and says, it's not that you're doing a minor Lifnei Iver. It's not Lifnei Iver. You're helping them. You're helping them by making things not as bad as they were. Even though you're actively, that takes the form of giving them food. That's also midrabbanan. Says Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, the reality is there are different types of people that don't make brachas. One could say, in the times of the Shulchan Aruch, if a person didn't make a bracha, they knew that that was wrong. And if you don't give them food, they understand why, and they accept it. And they know that they're in the wrong. But there's so many other different types of situations now where there could be any number of reasons why a person doesn't make a bracha. He wasn't brought up to make a bracha. He doesn't know. Something happened. And now here you are a Torah observant person. And he has just, for example, made a delivery to your house. It's a hot day. And he'd like a cup of water. And you say no. Because it seems to you pretty clear he's not going to make a bracha. Says the Shlomo Zalman, if you don't give him that cup of water, he is about to violate a prohibition that is much worse than drinking without a bracha, and that is developing a negative attitude, sina we would call, towards Torah. Here's an Orthodox person who won't even give me a drink of water. That's an aveira. But that's what will happen. That's like non-kosher food min haTorah. You are saving him from that. It's not ideal if only everyone would make brachas all the time. It's not ideal that he's not making a bracha. But this is like a derabbanan prohibition. You're saving him from something which is much worse, and that is absolutely the recommended course of action. Needless to say, many situations are different, and as this discussion is cited from Rav Shlomo Zalman, it's not a black or white thing. It's not, if you give him, he'll definitely not make a bracha. What if you can prevail upon him to make a bracha? And there's many ways you can do that. It could be that if you say macha bracha, it's not going to really help. But there are so many ways. If you say thank you so much, it would be a great honor for our house if you would recite a blessing for us. Who would not respond to something like that? It's actually recorded, and it's Teras Chaim. It's Teras Chaim. Rav Shlomo Zalman himself was in this situation, and someone came to his house, and Sir Rav Shlomo Zalman says, please, make a bracha. And this person was so taken by it. He said, I haven't made a bracha in 13 years. I myself don't make brachas. No one ever told me to. You're the first person that's offered me to make a bracha. So obviously, if you're Shlomo Zalman Orbach, no one can resist. For people that know of his persona. But even so, and what this teaches us is, aside from anything else, is that very often the very same situation can have such diametrically different outcomes based purely on approach. How do you look at this situation? With goodwill or with disdain and antipathy or worse? And I think as we're within the discussion of Lifnei Iver, and as the Rambam said, his amazing words themselves, a person who wants to do an Aveira is a blind person. If you see someone who's blind, you can either castigate them for being blind, that will help, or maybe you could pity them for being blind, or maybe you could do something else. Maybe you could give them vision. Here's a person that doesn't have such a positive relationship with mitzvahs. Apparently, he's not of the bracha rishona persuasion, but maybe he never met a person that represents brachas that would influence him to be so. But you could be that person. The exact same situation. Instead of saying, here's a blind person, what am I going to do? Say, here's a blind person, how can I open their eyes? And that, I think, certainly is a message from Lifnei Iver. Wherever possible, we're full of love for the Jewish people. There's plenty of nations that are full of other feelings for the Jewish people, for the entire Jewish people. And therefore, they don't really make many distinctions between this type and that type. We're aware of certain distinctions, but the question is, how does that relate to the way that we feel about each other? The Jewish people are family, never more so than in times such as these. And if we take the message from Lifnei Iver, as from all of the psukim that we discussed this evening in the parsha, Mitzvah Hashem, they should lead to shutting down the sale of Mechiras Yosef. And that should only lead for us, for Besiras Tovos, Yeshua's Menachamos Bekarov. All the best.